Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Jared Spector. We also talk about the 70th Annual Theatre World Awards, Irma LaDuce at City Center Encores, and the City of Conversation at the Mitzi Newhouse Theatre. Please stay tuned.
And someday, someway, I'll meet her. She'll be kind of shy and real good looking too. And I'll be certain she's my girl by the things she like to do, like walking in the rain and wishing on the stars up above and being so in love.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, May 11th, 2014. Happy Mother's Day. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantiere. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a special guest, Jared Spector from Beautiful, the Carol King musical, has gotten up on an early Sunday morning to be with us. Jared, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you for having me. And I know it's not early for everybody. It's just the theater schedule sort of skews things a little bit.
Oh, no, it's early for everybody. It's Sunday morning. It's beautiful. Which is beautiful. I didn't even mean to do that.
No, we have trouble with that. You can't. It's hard to use that as an adjective around the theater anymore.
Yeah. You know, it's when you're doing Jesus Christ Superstar and you say, "Can we, Jesus Christ?" when you say, "Can we start again, please?" And it throws everybody off. The Peter always runs out and said, "It's my song." So, Jared. So, what's it been like? A couple of weeks here to get your hands around what is going on in your life. Has it exploded?
Oh yeah. I mean, I really still haven't wrapped my mind around it completely. I'll be honest with you. I grew up singing and being a sort of a part of this community from a pretty young age. I mean, I was in Les Miserables when I was 9. Oh. So I sort of had some idea of the Tony Awards in my consciousness. And then, as I got older, I realized how hard it is just to work, you know, just to have a job that pays, let alone, a job in a good show, let alone a show that's received well on Broadway. And it's just, that idea of the Tony Awards went from something like, oh, I wonder if that might happen one day, to an absolutely no way, no how, pipe dream fantasy that only happens to movie stars on TV. So the fact that that they called my name, last week is still sort of hard to accept as true. But, I do all these interviews now, so it must be real.
I was just going to say that you're between doing eight a week and Beautiful, and being in a hit show has its, taxing abilities on you already. Now being a nominee, you must be very busy. But you mentioned that, did you mention you're from Philadelphia?
No, but I am in fact from Philadelphia.
So you're from Philadelphia. You went to Princeton. Did you sing in any of the great groups at Princeton?
You know, I didn't do the any of the a cappella groups at Princeton, but I was in the Triangle Club.
Okay.
So that, and that's kind of a full-time job there if you're familiar with it. So that's what I did when I was there. And they're such a great group. I mean, I'll be honest, that was the thing that sort of kept me sane when I was at Princeton, because I had quit the, quote, business when I was 15, when I was in a sitcom pilot for NBC that didn't work out, and I was really shaken up by it, and I sort of reexamined my very young life, as sort of maturely as I could, and thought that I was sort of dealing with grown-up problems that seemed a little unfair and a little beyond me. So I quit, and then I worked real hard and went to school, figuring I would just be, you know, sort of what I considered normal. And, you know, 2 years of studying economics and finance and Chinese was like, you know, sort of put me on a path to having a nervous breakdown. But the Triangle Club really kept me sane and happy. And, you know, they're such a great group, and the ability to have this creative outlet and to be able to, you know, write comedy sketches and comedy songs and perform them in the MacArthur Theater, and, you know, they and to be able to tour the show around the country for 2 years, you know, really sort of put me back in touch with who I am, you know, who I was nurtured to be, and who I probably, you know, in my quiet hours admit that that's my nature as well.
I want to know, did you know from the very first preview that you were in a hit? Did the audience take to it right away?
The audience took to it right away. We did a preview in San Francisco, and the audience took to it immediately. And I guess even from the first show, we were all like, wow, this could really be something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to tell when you're, you know, these shows go from little readings in rehearsal rooms, you know, very well lit rehearsal rooms where there's no, you know, there's no glamour of the theater. There's none of the mystery. It's just you and a bunch of, you know, it's just a bunch of actors behind music stands and an audience. And they're, you know, they're 3 feet from you. You know, so from that room, I had no idea. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I thought it was a good show. I thought, you know, obviously the music is killer, but how mm-hmm. many, you know, sort of bio musicals, jukebox musicals come along right. now, and some are good and some are quite bad.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
And so, you know, it's sort of, and I think the stigma of being in a show like that requires that it be even better, you know, than a brand new musical might have to be. Just, you know, just by nature of it having this pre-existing songbook, you know, you better find some integrity and you better tell a good story, because otherwise it's, you know, people might as well go see a concert.
Well, I guess you've certainly lucked out in being in two of the very best of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as I actually knock wood right here. But yes, I have been really lucky to have been a part of these two shows. You know, Jersey Boys, I arrived a little bit late. I started the tour, you know, where I was in the original First National tour a year after Broadway had opened. So the hype for Jersey Boys was still really quite high, but I knew what I was getting into, you know. I mean, I knew it was already a hit. It had already won the Tony and everything. This time, you know, it's starting from scratch and hoping that the thing that you're a part of, that you see, you know, little bits and pieces of greatness in it, you know, you hope that it becomes what it might become. And to the credit of Mark Bruni, our director, and our Tony nominated book writer Doug McGrath, I mean, and really the entire team, including the, you know, the cast. I mean, we worked every day for 6 weeks in San Francisco, and then for you know, a month of rehearsal, 6 weeks in San Francisco, two more weeks of rehearsal, and then another 7.5 weeks of previews before we opened. And I mean, just about every single day there were changes made, and almost always to the good. And when they weren't good, they were taken out, you know, immediately, and everyone said, okay, that didn't work, let's try something else. I mean, everyone was so diligent and conscientious about the way they worked and improved this piece of theater until, you know, we got to opening night, and now, you know, and sort of, and here's what it is. And people really do love it. They connect to it. And I think, you know, more than anything, they leave the theater having had a really good time, and not just because the music is good.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Doug McGrath really has made us care for these people. Now, Carole King famously didn't show up for a long time. Did Barry Mann come and see you early on?
Yeah, Barry and Cynthia came to
the opening, right?
Well, they were at the opening in New York. They actually, earlier than that they came to a run of the show in San Francisco before we started previews. I think, you know, one of the couple of nights before we started previews in San Francisco, we did a full run of the show, you know, for what was supposed to be an empty house, but we knew that Barry and Cynthia were there. So, you know, they've been involved early on. And, you know, sort of we were able to both Anika Larson, who plays my show wife, and I were able to get our hands on our roles pretty firmly, you know, between rehearsals and tech before sort of having to, you know, deal with the pressure of the real life people, you know, being in the audience and watching us. So that was nice that we were able to do that. So we had a level of comfort being, you know, sort of having the idea that, okay, we know what our characters are, you know, we have a pretty good grasp of this, and then being able to meet them and spend time with them. And they are just, the loveliest people. I mean, they're, you know, for us, they have been so wonderfully supportive. I mean, I can't say enough good things about Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. They've been fantastic. And when we, you know, once we were able to spend time with them, everything we gleaned little nuggets of, you know, of their personalities and put them into the show and, you know, made our shows sort of that much more nuanced.
I got to meet them, not at your show because I wasn't there at the opening, but I think the next night they went to an event for Murder for Two. Okay. Off Broadway, and yes, you're right. They're just lovely. And I got to talk with them about, you know, it was kind of, I guess I turned into like a kid fan mm-hmm. again. And I got to talk to them about some of the great songs they wrote for the Partridge Family and the Monkees.
Yeah.
Which and your show, I believe that the Monkees are referred to, but not the Partridge Family. Is that right?
Yeah, the Monkees yeah. refer to mm-hmm. The song Pleasant Valley Sunday that Jerry Goffin and Carol King.
Right.
For the Monkees.
Yeah.
Now, Jared, were you cast because you really are a hypochondriac in real life? Was that typecasting?
No, that's not typecasting. I mean, like any good Jewish boy, I have a pretty good understanding of health and doctors, but I'm not a hypochondriac. I'm really uh-huh. not. And I watched enough Woody Allen and Paul Reiser and George Costanza uh-huh. growing up to sort of have an idea of what I thought might work based on, based on Doug McGrath's writing. And to his credit, you know, again, the characters are portrayed pretty honestly and accurately. So, you know, it's not a huge stretch. And I think I was cast more, I mean, just my basic nature. I'm a, you know, a Jewish kid from a Northeast city. I grew up singing the piano, you know, singing and playing the piano, and that's exactly Barry, you know? So just, uh-huh. you know, one's Philly and one's Brooklyn, but it's, you know, our natures are just not that far apart.
Jared, you were in the Easter Bonnet this year, weren't you?
We came to the Easter Bonnet. We didn't perform at the Easter Bonnet, but I was there.
But you weren't you on stage at the end?
I was on stage at the end. Yeah, we collected we were the first runner up for collecting the second most money on Broadway. We raised $208,000.
I have a great photo. I have to see if I can get it to you. It's from the left. It's Jesse, you, Brian Cranston, Idina Menzel, and Denzel Washington.
Yes, I would love that picture. Please send it. No one has sent me anything like that.
I will send it to you somewhere.
So, Jared, just before we wrap up here, tell us how you got from Princeton to where you are today. What was your path like? Because a lot of students listen to this broadcast. And they always have this question of, how do I get from where I am to where they are? What's your story?
Well, when I was at Princeton, I was not an acting major. All of my arts were with the Triangle Club again. And my classes were, I mean, I was an economics major. So wow. I was taking economics and finance and Chinese. And in retrospect, if I were able to do it completely again, I probably wouldn't have gone to Princeton in the first place. To be perfectly frank, I probably would have just forced myself to go to NYU. But I still had sort of fears of the big, scary city from being a kid and from it being loud and scary and smelly. And so I wanted to go, and I didn't want to. I at that point, I sort of had my mind wrapped around, I'm not going to be an actor. This is not going to be my life. It's too unstable. It's too difficult. It's too this X, Y, and Z. So I went to, you know, that's why I went to Princeton. But, you know, it just wasn't for me. It wasn't for me in terms of the academics, really. I mean, I can do the work. I could get by in my classes, and I did very well in my first year. But it just sort of staring down the barrel of being an investment banker just was not, it just didn't sit well with me. I mean, I felt like when I was in high school and, you know, you sort of do your work because your teacher said so. And you work real hard because everybody and your parents say so, and your teacher says so. And even if you think this calculus class will never help my life, you just do it because you're supposed to. And then when you get to college, it's just a little too close to becoming I feel like a lot of us consider to be an adult, a working adult. And then, you know, you sort of start to really assess assess the value of what I was doing for the rest of my life. And it didn't make sense to me. And so I really did have, I became depressed, and I was really upset, and I just didn't know what I was doing. I was floundering as a man, and I was so confused and sad, and I had to leave. You know, 2 years was enough, and you know, that was a difficult conversation to have with my parents, who were, you know, in retrospect, extremely understanding. I mean, it's hard to tell you that year Princeton was ranked number one in the U.S. News and World Report in universities. And so it's hard to tell your parents that at you know, 20 years old, I'm going to leave the best school in the world, maybe, and come home and try to figure out who the hell I am. And so I went home. I sang for a wedding and bar mitzvah band for a year. And then I moved to New York with my two best friends for the summer to take some classes and, you know, get into acting a little bit at NYU, sort of auditing some classes. And I fell in love with the city as an adult, you know, sort of taking the bull by the horns as an adult and doing it myself, you know, without a parent holding my hand, without somebody, you know, escorting me on the train or in the car, just by myself being here. And that sort of was the big transition for me. So I moved here completely by myself. I eventually got into the Atlantic Theater Company Acting Conservatory, and I did that, you know, pretty intensely for 2.5 years, realizing I had no idea how to act, and everything I had ever done had just been based on straight instinct and no technique. And so to have a real foundation and technique was really big for me. So, I was, of course, came out a total theater snob like all of the conservatory students do. So I came out saying, okay, I'm only going to do Chekhov, Shakespeare, Ibsen, Shaw. That's going to be it. That's it. Nothing else. And then, of course, I was playing Hamlet in their small off-Broadway theater, and I was cast in Jersey Boys. So that was a pretty obvious position. I mean, I had, you know, saying some of the most beautiful soliloquies ever written at night, and then during the daytime auditioning with, you know, just laced with profanity. So it was a weird juxtaposition, but that's really how it happened. And I don't mean to make it sound easy, because I went in a million auditions while I was in New York and throughout my entire life. And I had a manager at the time, so I was able to audition. But, you know, my big break came from being in Jersey Boys. And I don't know. I guess the lesson there for me and for anyone, you know, who wants to do it, I would say two things to anyone who ever asks me. One is, if you can imagine doing anything else, do it. I really did try to do something else. I gave it my very best shot. I gave it my, you know, studying until 2 o'clock in the morning, every day, every night, try to be something else, to do something else. And I couldn't do it. My soul just said no. So this is my only option, really, you know, and I do a lot of other things and I keep myself busy, but, you know, being a part of this this life and being an artist is the thing that I have to do. The other is, if you're going to do it, really commit to it, work your ass off, and do everything in your, you know, in your arsenal. You know, don't come out of school saying I'm only going to do, you know, the highest brow of all straight plays, because it's just, there isn't enough work just to do that. You know, you have to be able to flex every muscle that you have. So if you can sing, play the piano, play the guitar, if you are a painter, whatever it is, do everything and find a way to make it work for yourself.
Well, Jared, that's just incredibly awesome advice for all aspects of life, no matter how old you are.
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and joining us. And,
oh, my goodness. It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you both.
We hope to speak with you soon, all right?
Yeah.
Take care.
Okay, take it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now ain't it good to know that you got a friend when people can be so cold? They'll hurt you.
Yes, and desert you.
They'll take your soul if you let them. Oh, but don't you let them.
So let's start on our reviews. Irma LaDuce is playing at City Center Encores, and Peter and Michael have gotten a chance to see it. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, I have to say this was the fifth show I ever saw when I was just starting out as a teenager, and it taught me a lot. I didn't know very much about the world of prostitution at that time. When I came out of the show, I was a man. Anyway, so I have great fondness for this show under those circumstances. But, you know, because it was one of the first shows I ever saw, I remember it vividly. I mean, the shows that I saw back then were events. I used to go 8 times a year. So as a result, they stayed in my consciousness. So I remember blocking tremendously. Today, of course, you know, when I call my girlfriend in the morning and she said, what did you see last night? There's a 45-second pause where I try to remember what it was. So Irma is a show I know inside out. The original cast album is one I've memorized. So I wish I could be more enthusiastic about what's going on at City Center. But what really fascinated me more than anything else was the fact that this is really Nestor's show more than Irma's. He has much more to do than she does. And also he has to play a mistaken identity situation, because what's happening here is Irma is a prostitute, Nestor, a law student in this production, and not a policeman as he is in the movie. We'll talk about the movie a bit. He falls in love with her desperately, and he doesn't want her sleeping with other men, so he pretends to be this very rich man. He puts on a beard. A beard, by the way, in this production that would embarrass a community theater just starting out. It's almost like Groucho Marx glasses and nose. And he pretends to be somebody else, and she doesn't see through the ruse. But the point is, he has to work day and night to get the money to pay her, and he gets exhausted, so he decides to kill the false identity, and then he, because that man disappears, he goes on trial and he has to go to Devil's Island, and because he's found guilty, and then he escapes and makes his way back, and it all ends very happily. Comparing it to the 1963 movie that Billy Wilder did, you see some very interesting changes. There, as I say, Nestor was a policeman who tried to do the right thing in cleaning up corruption, only to find out that his boss was actually playing around with these pools, as the euphemism goes. Here it's just Nestor comes in as a law student and becomes a pimp virtually in a few minutes, because Irma has a protector, a pimp, who is not nice to her, and he stands up to him in this stage play. He stands up to him and uses some legal logic that convinces the guy to go away. In the movie, he fights him. He gets in lucky punches, believe me.
Wow.
But I mean, there's more to the movie in that circumstance. Of course, what the movie did do that was regrettable was omit the songs. it kept D Donk, one of the songs, and background music. You heard occasional songs, but nothing more than that. So it's a mixed blessing. Now here at City Center, it just never took off. The direction by John Doyle just wasn't right for it. It was lackadaisical. I think they would have been better off doing a cartoon. The way the original was. There was something cartoony about it. But, you know, the other thing, too, is this show is almost 60 years old. Granted, it opened in Broadway in 1960, but it opened in Paris in 1956. So that's almost 60 years suddenly. And the thing was, back then, this was hot stuff, you know, the idea of the world of a prostitute, the prostitute with the heart of gold. There weren't that many stories about that then, certainly not musicals. And people were somewhat titillated. I'm not saying scandalized, but I will say titillated by a look at this world. I find it very interesting, too, that on the original cast album, the first words you hear after the overture are, "Don't worry, it's suitable for the children." And this didn't show up yesterday, and I'm wondering if Gotthard Liebesen added that line. Because don't forget, Gotthard Liebesen, when he recorded cast albums, did not do much introductory dialogue. He thought it was a bad idea. But here he has that line in there. Now, it's very possible that's in the script, and John Doyle, who adapted it, by the way, for Encores, decided to drop that line. I can't say for sure what's going on there. But whatever the case, it wasn't there, and I certainly found that of more than moderate interest. So there were certain lines that really stuck out at me. Nestor said, "You forget time when you're happy." And, well, I'm afraid the time went very slowly while watching this production of Irma La Douce. Jessica Bowles got the biggest hand of the afternoon, I have to admit, when she did the title song. But when I say the biggest hand of the afternoon, that doesn't mean she stopped the show. I don't mean that at all. I simply mean the biggest hand. Rob McClure worked very, very hard in both roles. The supporting cast, I would have liked a little more character in the character, man. Irma's the only lady in the show, by the way. So everybody else's, and they just didn't have the personality for it. But my, it's funny that they talk about eventually winding up in the Arctic. Don't ask, but they wind up in the Arctic, which allows for a penguin ballet, which, you know, I mean, is the closest thing you can get to springtime for Hitler. But anyway, because there was there really was a chilliness about it that shouldn't have been there. It should have been warm. It should have been delightful. Cartoony, I think, as I say, would have been a good way to go too, but it moved as fast as a glacier, and I don't think because there's a scene set in the Arctic, you have to have a glacier-like pace. So I'm afraid Irma LaDuce was a disappointment.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, it was quite an experience for me because I basically went in cold. I'm sure I must have heard the original cast recording at some point, but it had been many, many years. I don't own it, although I've since borrowed it from a friend. Start with some questions for Peter. Peter, was your impression that the original production was also staged in a way that you had the idea that everything was actually happening within this bar?
No, by no means. By no means. No.
Okay.
No. There were genuine sets. They weren't elaborate, but they were genuine sets. I still remember when he came back from Desert Island. There's a Devil's Island. There's a very smart thing because he's been there and he's grown this beard. Now he really has a beard, and she mistakes him for Monsieur Oscar, the other identity. And I remember very vividly she was in the second floor of a an apartment building, looking down on him. And no, they weren't realistic sets, but very Belle Epoque type things, and skeletal. But no, there was nothing about taking place at a bar. That concept wasn't there at all, though it is here as you're introducing to us.
Well, the reason I ask that is because, in my opinion, even in the context that they did it at Encores, where it was presented as sort of all taking place within the bar, and there were for example, when they went to Devil's Island, they were still in, like, tuxedos or business. You know, I mean, even within that context, where it was so presentational, the plot struck me as so ridiculous.
Uh-huh.
That I could not quite believe what was happening from one moment to another.
I understand.
And I thought to myself, you know, but I would think that it would be even more ridiculous if they actually presented it as if these things were actually happening in these various locations. But on the other hand, you were so young when you saw it that maybe that wasn't an issue.
No, you know, another thing too that I think bears a great deal of examination anyway, involving this whole situation with the mistaken identity. In the movie, he only plays solitaire with her. But we get the impression here that he is having, shall we say, carnal knowledge with her. And there's a line. The good thing about Irma is that she doesn't remember faces. And that's supposed to get a laugh. But the point is, if you're naked, you know, from stem to stern, she would – believe me, when Jack Lemmon played it in the movie and went into this other identity, he didn't fool anybody in the audience. I mean, you still had to make that leap of faith. But at least there was a bit more rationale of his playing solitaire with her and not doing anything else. So even that here was far-fetched.
Do you think it's only implied in the musical that they're having carnal knowledge?
I will admit that. I mean, it's implied.
I thought it was more than implied.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's fine. I understand.
Oh, gosh,
that.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I got.
Yeah, I what I mean is that
they don't quite come out and say it.
That's
so
exactly
many.
What I mean. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
Well, now another thing, Peter. So after Nestor gets sent off to Devil's Island, and Irma is left pregnant, mm-hmm. And alone. And she even refuses the protection, quote unquote, of the police, whatever that was going to amount to. And she's also now completely given up being a prostitute. And in fact, we hear her slapping a series of men who come to try to, you know, to have carnal knowledge of her. How do we imagine she's supporting herself?
Yeah, very good point.
Right. I was like, what? Maybe she's got a trust fund we don't know about.
I guess she's living. Maybe she put some money aside. I guess that's the best we can hope for, because she was doing awfully well. Linda said, which was something too, that this whole business. You see a scene early on where all the men are lined up to, shall we say, visit Irma and do business with her, and when Nestor becomes Monsieur Oscar and they don't have her anymore, nobody seems to even make any noise about that whatsoever. They seem to accept that, that they don't get her anymore, while it seemed to be that they were really involved with her. So there's something to be said for that too. So I do see some plot holes here. So in a way, Billy Wilder improved it. In a way, he didn't, because I was told by our frequent listener, John Moss, that Billy Wilder later said, you know, I should have done it as a musical. And if that's the case, I'm sorry he didn't, too.
Well, but having said that, I would say, and I imagine you'd agree, that the music is the best part of it. Marguerite Monod, who co-wrote several of Edith Piaf's most famous songs with her. So as I said to someone last night, well, you can't really get much more authentic than that. But one of the things that also drove me crazy last night was that, this is written into it. The story is narrated basically by this character, Bob Le Hotu, played by Malcolm Getz in this production. And the whole first 5 minutes, it seems like, is him explaining all of these French terms to us, so that they can use them without, you know, rather than using the English equivalents every time, and therefore make it seem more of a French story. So he explains what poules are, which, you know, poule means, I guess, chicken, but in this case it means the prostitutes, and the mech is their guys, and so on and so on. But also, for all of that, there was a lot of mispronunciation going on, and it really drove me crazy. For example, pool, the plural of it, if you were to say it in French, you would not pronounce the S.
Yes.
Now, I realize that if you were to say it without the S in English, that would confuse people. Uh-huh. But the fact remains that it is still wrong. And so every time they did that, I was like, what? And then this was amazing to me. All of these mechs, you know, who hang out in the bar and are customers or whatever of Irma, they are all have names like Jojo Les Yeux, Roberto Les Diames, Persil Le Noir, Polite Lemou, but every time that anyone said one of these names, they said La instead of Le. And anyone who knows anything about French, La is feminine and Le.
Sure.
So little things like that. I mean, in some ways they were very meticulous, and in other ways they were completely not. Also, I'm sure, obviously this is written into the show too. But it seemed to me that the expression "dis donc" was said or sung about 100 times during the show.
Without letting us know what it means?
I looked at it. I knew that expression years ago. It was I remember taking French, and it was in one of the little dialogues that we learned. It's almost a throwaway phrase that means almost anything. I just looked it up. It means, it can mean wow.
Yeah.
It can mean goodness. Mm. It can just mean hey. You know, hey, what's going on? By the way, well, or listen. Mm-hmm. So basically it means nothing. It's almost like saying, so, you know, so those little things, really added up. Plus the fact that the book seems so incredibly weird to me. I will say that I think from a musical standpoint, Encores did an excellent job with it. And, I don't know. It's impossible to say. I don't know if it could work at all today. that show in an English production, or maybe even a French production. I mean, because things have changed. So it's one of those cases where something has almost, it seems like it was maybe almost sui generis when it opened, but now it's become so much part of the culture, those types of characters and things that they seem terribly cliche to us. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's, you know, it was very worthy effort and certainly different from a lot of other things Encores has done. Interesting to note, it seemed to have more of a set than any other Encores production I can think of at the moment.
Yes, and notice there wasn't a book to be found even remotely. I mean, they were raring to go.
No, and a friend of mine commented on that because he doesn't see all of them, and he said, yeah, this one and Happy Fella, I noticed no books, and I said, yeah, I think they've kind of changed the... I
thoroughly agree.
Yeah, the rules to get away from that.
And in terms of the way things have changed with Encores, too, let's not forget that for this production, Jack Viertel has admitted the tail wagged the dog to some degree. In other words, what I'm talking about is one of the reasons he chose Irma LaDuce was the fact that it was a less expensive show than many others, because the orchestra wasn't as big. And the thing was, Most Happy Fella was so expensive.
Yes.
He had to make up the deficit in some way or other. And so as a result, this is what he chose. Still, come on. I mean, this was a hit. I mean, it ran, 524 performances, rings a bell with me, back then, which was a long run back then. And, you know, there's every reason, it got a movie sale. I mean, there's every reason to believe that it was worth seeing again, you know, and it wasn't until they got it up there. And again, as I say, lackluster direction, too. I have to admit that. So this was a misfire. Okay, these things happen, but... But anyway, it is sort of sad that it somewhat came about from the vantage point of we got to save a buck and this is the best we can do. But if this is what we had to do to get the Most Happy Fella, all right.
Oh, you know, one other thing I have to mention, this fascinated me. I wonder if Bob Fosse knew this show. I noticed several things that really reminded me of Chicago. From that very first speech, and I wish I could had either one of them verbatim, but at the beginning of Chicago, as we know, one of the ensemble men comes out and says something like, this is a story of greed and corruption and blah, 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 all the things that we hold dear to our hearts. Mm-hmm. And it gets a laugh, and then the show starts. And in this case, Malcolm Getz, as Bob Le Hotu, came out and said, this is a story of, and then I guess he said something like, passion and sex and blah, 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 blah. And then the next line was something like, all of those things we love so much. And I thought, wow. All right. Do you know the line? I'm sorry.
Well, no. What I was also going to say is that John Kander wrote the dance music for Irma LaDuce. And in fact, I was at the talkback yesterday giving his experience. I was sorry to say I couldn't stay and hear him. But you even hear, when you hear the dance music in the Arctic scene, the Penguin Ballet, I'm serious, you can even hear that it sounds a lot like the Hot Honey Rag. So it's funny that Chicago comes in there too.
Oh, well, anyway, that did remind me of Chicago. And then, so the mock trial that's played out in a very cartoonish way.
I
was going to say the whole concept of something, you know, in the case of Chicago, all the numbers being presented as basically sort of vaudeville turns. And here in this production, it was almost as if you were in a cabaret.
Sure.
You know, and the numbers were cabaret numbers, but it sounds like the original was made an attempt to be more, you know, more realistic, quote unquote.
Anyway, for people who don't know the show, though, I do recommend the original cast album tremendously. But boy, I'm still surprised that Elizabeth Seale won that Tony. I mean, it really does underline how much of a disappointment Camelot must have been for Julie Andrews not to win the role, the prize. And also Carol Channing and Nancy Walker were up for it, too. But so Elizabeth Seale must have really been dynamite in this role, unless it was a case that, you know, like everybody voted for everybody else just week three. Through, you know, one of those situations. But one has to wonder about this award because Irma just doesn't seem to be doing that much. I mean, much of the time she's in the bedroom, you know, I mean, entertaining people we don't see. So, you know, it really surprised me. And in fact, here, Rob McClure got the last bow. You know, not Irma LaDuce, yes. Deducted the last bow in Irma LaDuce, you know, and that tells you something, too.
What,
so,
Peter, what show was Carol Channing up for?
Her own show called Showgirl.
Oh, yes.
It was a review. There is an album of it. In which she does a hellishly clever parody of Oklahoma. And Nancy Walker was for Do-Re-Mi. But really, I mean, that was the year that Camelot did not get a Best Musical nomination. They left the category. They had an empty space, just like they did this year. An empty space, which really told Camelot, we don't think you're any good at all. You know, so very interesting.
That's ironic, given how much Camelot has done.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe when the summer gets slow, we can do a whole podcast on that, because every time I think of that show, I find something else wrong with it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Every single time I think of a lyric, I find something else wrong with it.
my estimation of it only grows. So, really? So we will have a very good heated discussion on it. Yeah.
Well, you and Gerard, but no.
Oh, he likes it too?
Oh, yeah. He loves it.
Uh-huh. So does Ethan Morden. Yeah. Ethan goes to bat for quite a bit in his 60s book. It's one of the first chapters. If listeners out there don't know Ethan Morden's book, please get every one of them, even the make-believe book, which costs a fortune because there aren't many of them around. That was the one about the 20s. But, boy, he is our finest writer about musical theater. Tremendous mind, tremendous books, hilariously funny, and many times quite outrageous, quite outrageous. What he says about Zorba, well, anyway, this is a family podcast. We won't use profanity. He does, though. Yeah. So
Irma LaDuce is running through this afternoon, the 11th of May, which is Sunday. We're recording on Sunday at City Center Encores. So if you're listening to this, you've missed it. So it's interesting because. Obviously, it seems as though that this could never have a commercial run. So this is, in my opinion, I didn't see Irma. So I'm just talking about the City Center in general. It's great that they've done it because obviously we'd never see it in any other venue.
Yeah, well, another thing, too, I've heard for years that one of the reasons we haven't seen it had to do with the fact that the French estate and the English estate states... plural. We can use the plural there, Michael. have had great difficulty in coming to terms with what should happen. I mean, there's some sort of financial thing. Mel Miller did Irma LaDuce some years ago. I didn't see it there at Musicals Tonight. He told me he had a tough time getting the rights for it. Some of it has to do with that, too.
It might conceivably be successful in a very small production in almost like a cabin. The show started, apparently, in a very small theater.
That's right.
In Paris. That was, I get the impression it was almost more like a cabaret theater. Mm-hmm. If anything, I think, not exactly ideal for City Center, which even with the number of seats that they removed, what is it like, still like 2,200?
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, it did run in Paris at least 4 years, because the original cast album, which came out in 1960, mentions it's been playing 4 years and it's still running. I can't find anywhere on the internet when it closed, but in London it ran 1,512 performances. So that's a nice long run, too. So there's no question at one time this was quite a hit.
Next up, we talk about The City of Conversation, which is at the Mitzi Newhouse Theater, and Peter and Michael had a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, I would say overall, it's a quite a good play. A new world premiere production by Anthony Giardina at the Mitzi Newhouse at Lincoln Center, and it's basically set in three. There are three scenes, I guess, three time periods represented. It's set in Georgetown, and the central character is a woman named Hester Ferris, played by Jan Maxwell, and she is a very high-powered hostess in D.C., where it's very much all about these very A-list parties where the creme de la creme of the political world and related fields come and talk and I guess maybe one might say network and form alliances and things like that. And she's, you know, she knows everyone. The names that are dropped in the play, even like within the first 5 or 10 minutes, are pretty amazing. And the first scene is set in 1979 during the Carter presidency. The second scene is set in 1987 during the second Reagan presidency term. And the final scene is set right on, actually, I believe, the evening of the Obama inauguration in 2009. And this is interesting because Hester is a very liberal Democrat. And what happens is that her son goes off to school in England at the London School of Economics, and he comes back with a girlfriend, and they both seem to be, as I wrote in my review, moving towards the dark side.
Yeah.
I mean, as some of us would put it, in that they're becoming very conservative Republicans. And so the play is about, in macrocosm, I guess it's about the breakdown of civility in political discussion since, you know, from the 70s, certainly, until now. You know, I mean, all this yelling and screaming and everyone, you know, is seeing every issue in black and white, and compromise is a dirty word and blah, 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 blah. But then in microcosm, the play is about what happens when you're close, the people closest to you in the world wind up having very different political views. And that's basically what happens here. I thought a lot of it was really well written, as talky, quote unquote, as it is. But that's not necessarily a bad thing when the conversation is so interesting. The other characters include, yes, Hester lives with her sister. Her sister lives with her in this beautiful home. She's played by Beth Dixon. The son is named Colin. He's played by Michael Simpson. And the girlfriend, eventually wife of Colin, is played by Kristen Bush. And then we have several other characters, including the 6-year-old son of Colin and Anna, and then one or two other characters. But my only real problem with it was, and it was a plot device. There's a scene where Hester is basically playing with young Ethan at age 6, and he's got a favorite rubber ball that he plays with around the house and blah, blah, blah. And she's just being very grandmotherly to him. But then she starts indoctrinating him with what an evil person Robert Bork is, because now we're in the second Reagan term, Ronald Reagan presidency term, and Bork is up for a nomination to the Supreme Court. And it just and this is a setup, and I won't tell you what the payoff of the setup is, because I guess that would qualify as a big spoiler. But I think it is fair to say that that just the fact that she's, you know, it came off to me like brainwashing. I mean, not a 6-year-old. I just don't think that's really appropriate to explain your political beliefs, you know, in very specific, detailed ways to a 6-year-old who just wants to play with his rubber ball. And that made that, it may sound like not such a big deal, but that just really changed my view of the character of Hester. I mean, she suddenly became kind of something that she was not trying to be. I mean, she just became this very rigid, you know, well, you know, this is the way it is, and controlling, and you know, everyone else has to think the way I do, and my grandson is going to. So I thought that was a really big mistake, and I thought unnecessary too. It could have been written in a way that she wasn't so dogged in trying to get this 6-year-old to hate Robert Bork. So I'm sorry that the playwright didn't give that section another pass. But But other than that, it really is. It's a very interesting subject that I find myself. I certainly had noticed, and I'm sure many of us have, that this breakdown in civility and just how angry and defensive people become now when they discuss politics, as opposed to in the old days, seems to me, and I guess it seems that way to Anthony Giardina also. So very, very wonderful production. One of John Lee Beatty's most gorgeous sets, and I don't have to tell you what a compliment that is. And very well directed by Doug Hughes at the Mitzi Newhouse.
All right, Peter, what did you think?
I liked it substantially more. One of the things that interested me is in the first scene when Jan Maxwell's character goes to bat with Kristen Bush's character, that young woman does not give in at all. At one point, Jan Maxwell says, "Young lady," and she says, "My name is Anna." And right then and there, you know that this is quite a force. Now, what surprised me, and the playwright was much more clever than I, in the second scene, again, as Michael says, 8 years later, now we're talking about a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. And what I fully expected was the fact that because 8 years had passed, each of them had become inured to each other, and each of them was going to be civil to each other, because what are you going to do? They got married. All right, let's make the best of it. Hardly. It's escalated. The fight between the two of them, between liberal and conservative, has gotten far worse, and the stakes become immeasurably high as the scene goes on. Frankly, I thought Jean Maxwell in these first two scenes was magnificent, but I also thought that Kristen Bush was equally magnificent. The thing is, what I wasn't prepared for was what Jan Maxwell would be in the third scene, which was tremendously more potent, because she was devastated at events. It is hard to talk about this play without spoiling, but yes. Nevertheless, something happened to her that really devastated her. And yet, the point of the play is that this woman believes that any sacrifice she has made in her personal life is worth it for the greater good of making things better politically for this country. So as a result, you know, I didn't have the problem that Michael had with their indoctrinating the kid. I understand that that's not a great thing to do, believe me.
Well, and only because of his sickness.
All set. You know, I mean, you know, don't forget Gene Brody says, "Give me a girl in an impressionable age, she is mine for love, a life." And that's a bad thing. You know, I mean, you know, we later realize that Gene Brody is, you know, really playing mind games. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is consistent with her character, who believes that no matter what you do in your personal life, it is not as important as the greater good politically to make things happen in this country for people at large, that you have to sacrifice your own personal lives to have something that impacts the entire society. So it's consistent to me. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that I'm viewing it as a right thing that a kid at 6 years old. I mean, I remember seeing a documentary back in the 70s about American Nazis, and there were little children, you know, 4 and 5 years old, yeah, saying, "Hitler is good. Hitler was a good man," you know, because that's what they've been taught. I mean, and, you know, one can effectively argue that this is not very much different, you know, even though it seems to be, because we're more on the side of many of us who at least are talking here today or listening here today, we're more of a liberal bent. Michael talked about things being black and white. I guess what we really mean is red and blue. But nevertheless, you know, it really is a case where this woman is devoted to the political cause, and she is willing to give up her personal life to make that happen. So that worked for me, even though I'm not condoning what she did.
I understand. It just made me,
I understand,
lose some respect for
of
her.
Of course.
You know. Yeah.
Of course. You know, but a terrific play. And, you know, let me say this. I really believe that even if you are apolitical or somebody who doesn't follow politics all that much, that you won't be intimidated by this play. I think they really, both the performers and the playwright and the director, Doug Hughes, did a fabulous job as well, really make it easy for you.
And I wish we could tell you more about the final scene, because but we really can't.
No.
Let's say there's a new character introduced. Actually,
yes.
Yeah, well, there's a new character introduced.
And a very important character who doesn't show up at all. Somebody we've come to really, because circumstances have changed in that person's life, too. So, I think this is quite a work. And I was riveted from the beginning right to the end. And Jan Maxwell, to me, almost was unrecognizable in that third scene. I'm telling you, we are so lucky to have this lady. She is so spectacular, everything she does. I mean, there was a play at Lincoln Center by Jules Feiffer. I think it was called The Bad Friend, and she was so terrific in that, too. I mean, this theater is very good to her, she really gives memorable performances every time she steps out there. So, and this is somebody I would imagine that the general populace has no idea even exists, but believe me, they should, because she really is magnificent.
Jan Maxwell, 5-time Tony nominee.
Yeah, but no wins yet, you know. So
was she a Theatre World Award winner?
Not that I know of. No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Well, why don't we talk about this year's Theatre World Awards? The announcement was made this week that we have a whole slate of new winners for this season, and that the next Theatre World Awards ceremony, the 70th annual, is that correct? June 2nd at Circle in the Square, 6:45 p.m.
No, 7:45. It was announced at 6:45. Yes, indeed. You're not wrong. You're reading it correctly. However, we've had to change it for an hour later because there's a big Tony shindig that night from 5:30 to 7:30. So as a result, and so many of our people turn out to be Tony nominees. You know, I'm a little saddened by the list in one respect, that there is not one off-Broadway person represented on this list. Every one of these people has been in a Broadway show. And I don't think this has happened since the 50s. I'm going to do my homework and find out if it is true. But I think, you know, one can also look at the glasses more than half full and saying that this was such a rich Broadway season that that's why it turned out the way that it did. Seven of us judges. What we do is we vote 6-5-4-3-2-1. We pick our there were many more men this year. There was literally twice as many men eligible this year than women. Literally, to the past. 132 men, 66 women. I mean, that's just the way it played out. And therefore, we had a much tougher time sorting through the men than we did through the women. I was very surprised that it was all it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was in bed and I was awake, and suddenly my eyes flew open and I rushed to the list. I said, oh my God, it's all Broadway. I feel terrible, you know, but really so many off-Broadway people missed by an eyelash. I will say, I can't tell you too much about this, but I will say we even had to have a runoff. There was a tie and we had to vote again. But I have to admit that person was in a Broadway show too. So it was a tough year, but anyway, we're very pleased to mention that Paul Chahiti from 12th Night, Nick Cordero from Bullets Over Broadway, Brian Cranston from All the Way, Mary Bridget Davies from A Night with Janis Joplin, Sarah Green from The Cripple of Inishman, Rebecca Hall from Machinal, Ramin Karimloo from Les Mis, Zachary Levi for First Date, Chris O'Dowd for Of Mice and Men, Sophie Okonedo from Raisin in the Sun, Emerson Steele, The Young Girl in Violet, and Lauren Worsham from Gentleman's Guide turned out to be our 12 winners. We picked 6 men, 6 women. Also, the Dorothy Loudon Foundation, God love them, is a big sponsor of our awards, and their committee picks whom they think gave the most dynamic performance this year, and Celia Keenan-Bonser for The Glass Menagerie was their choice. We certainly had no problem with it. And also, there's a John Willis Award. John Willis was head of this organization for well over 30 years. And an award was established in his honor last year. He died the year before. And So Christopher Plummer is going to be this year's winner, and he'll be at the ceremony on June 2nd. So at this point, it seems like everybody but Paul Chahiti will be there. Paul Chahiti is busy in London in rehearsal for the straight play version, on stage version of Shakespeare in Love. So so that's kind of interesting, too, that he's in a Shakespearean production again of sorts. So so he's not going to be there, but everybody else, we're told, will show up and collect a prize. So so I'll be emceeing the ceremony at Circle in the Square, which is great because it's set up so nicely with those tables that Donald faces every night. So we're going to have the winners and the presenters sitting at those tables, and the rest of the audience will, of course, be in the rest of the seats. So so I'm looking forward to it. I already have three good jokes, which puts me ahead of usual. I mean, usually at this point I have one. I have three, though I know that I'm going to get groans on two of them, but I'm going to say them anyway. But anyway.
You live for those groans, Peter.
I don't know about that. No, two of them are rather severe, you know, so but we'll see how they play out, you know. So but I, Michael, I always love when I hear your distinctive laugh in the audience.
Well, I don't think you're going to hear it this year, only because the Astaire Awards are that night.
There's a million things going on that night. So no
Monday nights, Monday nights in the spring. Yes.
Yep. No question. You know, no hard feelings. We understand that nobody can be in two places except St. Martin de Porres, if you know your Roman Catholic liturgy. But anyway, those who will be there, as the Beatles used to say, a splendid time is guaranteed for all.
Well, I'm especially happy. I love this list. I think it's wonderful. I'm really happy to see Zachary Levi in, because I think First Date was, because it was in the fall and it was it's closed, it's been ignored. And I thought that he was wonderful and charming in the role.
He won in a walk. There wasn't any. It wasn't hard getting him on the list. Believe me, it was. I agree with you. In fact, I'd even say it was summer when he opened his show. So as a result, it is. It's always very impressive when a person who opens so early can be remembered so late. You know, and we're delighted that I'm delighted that everybody. All seven people remembered Zachary Levi fondly. So so that
for
was
really- what it's worth, in retrospect, that show is looking better and better to me. I think for what I always said from the beginning, for what it was, I thought it was just fine. Very entertaining and funny. Nice score. You know, nothing earth shattering, but nothing terribly wrong with it. And when you look at some of the things that have opened since then, I would take that show any day.
I also think that the authors really did their homework. They must have pulled hundreds of people saying, okay, what happens on a first date? Because it really seemed they got all the assets and liabilities of that. So my hat's off to them for that as well.
Yep.
But and speaking of being off, I'm going to have to be off right now. I have to go to a reading at 12 o'clock at Battery Place, wherever the hell it may be. So wish me luck and hope I find it and hope I get there on time.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
All right. Have a good one, Peter. All right, so Michael, let's wrap up now.
Yeah, I usually get lost when I go down to Battery Place.
Yeah, I absolutely understand that. So, anything you want to add in for this week before we wrap up?
Oh, a couple of things. I misspoke slightly last week on two little things. We were talking about cabaret and I mentioned how Cliff sings a little bit at the end of the show when he's on the train leaving Berlin, and and I believe I said he sings cabaret, but of course he sings Phil Collins. So sorry, I misspoke. And then also I just left an entire I thought I said it, but I listened to the podcast and I realized I didn't. In Kristen Chenoweth's concert, she did two duets with Deborah Voigt. They did Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better, and that was, you know, a challenge duet, which includes always includes one per, you know, Anything You Can Sing, I Can Sing Higher. Mm-hmm. So they did that. And in that case, you know, it went really well as far as the notes. But although they did screw up the lyrics two or three times, and Deborah Voigt turned to the audience and said, clearly we needed more rehearsal on this. But then they did a sort of a combo of You'll Never Walk Alone and Climb Every Mountain. And that was the number where at the end they both were singing is higher and higher. And Kristen hit a note which had to be above a high C, I think maybe an E flat. And she didn't exactly crack, but she only held it for like, a couple of seconds, and then she let it go because she was going to lose. She knew she was losing it. Mm-hmm. And Deborah Voigt stopped, she didn't want to keep on singing. And the audience was very very supportive and gave them a lot of applause. And then Deborah Voigt left. And then Kristen, what she did was then she hit the note a cappella. And the audience went wild, and she said, I wouldn't have been able to sleep tonight if I didn't do that. But then what happened was that the doors opened and Deborah Voigt came back out unplanned, and the orchestra struck up like the last stanza, I guess, of Climb Every Mountain, and they both sang it again, and this time Kristen hit the note beautifully and held it through. But I couldn't help thinking to myself that it was almost like karma bit her in the butt a little bit, because doing a challenge like that in anything you can do is one thing, but in You'll Never Walk Alone and Climb Every Mountain, I don't know if that's really supposed to be about so much about this is how high I can sing. So I did get a little chuckle about that, how that little karmic bite in the butt that she got. But she had the last word, and as I said, it's thank God she hit the note so beautifully the second time, because if she hadn't, that would have been kind of embarrassing.
All right, so let's wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can go to broadwayradio.com and find contact information for Michael or for Peter or for me. Also listed there are links to some of the things we've talked about today, as well as other stuff like information for Jared Spector or the Triangle Club, the Theater World Awards, things like that. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Moreno saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Baby, I'm amazed at the way you love me all the time. Maybe I'm afraid of the way I love you. Baby, I'm amazed at the way you pulled me out of time. You hung me. I'm amazed at the way I really need you.